Good morning.
Good morning.
So your programs today have the title, One Moon in Every Pool. And the following quote from Dogen Zenji. If you follow the river all the way back to its source, there are the clouds. If you follow the clouds all the way back to their source, there is the river. So I'm going to talk about that, and I'm going to talk about it in a couple different ways. Starting with a very famous koan that many of you know. The version I'm going to read you is from Dogen's 300 koan, Shobo Genzo, and he titles it number 201. It has different titles depending on what collection it's being taken from. It's usually titled something like Bodhidharma's Departure or Bodhidharma's Skin, Flesh, Bones, and Marrow. The story is about the Indian meditation teacher we call Bodhidharma, who is said to have brought the essence of Zen from India to China in roughly, we don't know, 500 AD? I could be off by a couple hundred years, we don't know. But he's said to be kind of the founder of Zen, and so when he's leaving China to return, he has to choose a successor to carry on the tradition. That's kind of the context for the koan, for the story. So, Venerable Bodhidharma was about to go back to India. He said to his students, "The time has come. Can you express your understanding?" One of his students, Dao Fu, said, "My present view is that we should neither be attached to letters nor be apart from letters and allow the way to function freely." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my skin." The nun Zongshi said, "My view is that it is like the joy of seeing Buddha's land just once and not again." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my flesh." Daoyu said, "The four great elements are originally empty, and the five skandhas do not exist. Therefore, I see nothing to be attained." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my bones." Finally, Daizu Hueku came forward, made a full bow, stood, and returned back to where he was. Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my marrow." And thus he transmitted the Dharma and the robe to Hueku. So that's our story. That's our koan. Is this familiar to some of you folks? Some of you know it very well. There's a lot going on here, and there's lots of different ways we could take this today. If you follow the river all the way back to its source, there are the clouds. If you follow the clouds all the way back to their source, there is the river. So this means no source. Shitu, our Chinese ancestor in the Zen tradition, in the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage says, "The vast inconceivable source cannot be faced or turned away from." He's sort of reifying the idea of a source there, an origin point, but he's also making sure it's non-conceptual. You can't face it or turn away from it. If you follow the river all the way back to the source, there are the clouds. If you follow the clouds all the way back to their source, there's the river. Only source, no source. This means source leaves nothing unenlightened on earth. It means that we were born of the rays of original majesty, original awakening. It means the finite and the infinite are both ungraspable. Breath outside of our body we call air. Air inside our body we call breath. One we think of as impersonal, unseen, not me. One we think of as personal, life itself. If I follow the air, I get to the breath. If I follow the breath, I get to the air. There are not two separate things. Skin, flesh, bones, and marrow is what Bodhidharma gives to his students. You have attained my skin, you have attained my flesh, you have attained my bones, you have attained my marrow. Who wins? Who wins when there are no separate things? The river is the clouds, and the clouds are the river, and there are two things, and there are not two things. The skin is the marrow is the skin. There is one moon, there are many pools. You see all the metaphors we use here, right? I'm throwing them all around. This idea of the one moon being reflected in the many pools, that the same moon is reflected in the puddle and the lake, is a metaphor Zen talks about to refer to original enlightenment, source, the absolute. You know, we always use the moon as our symbol for enlightenment, that original unclouded clarity. And when we say, oh, it's reflected in even the smallest piece of dew, the smallest drop of water, the puddle, the moon, we're using that as a metaphor for us. My zazen, my practice, my compassion, my wisdom, my awakening, not being separate from the source, the ultimate, the origin. Not being separate. One moon in many pools one moon. When we follow that reflected moon in the dewdrop all the way back to its source, when we follow the source. So what am I asking? What are we playing with here today? What I'm interested in is the question how close we are to source and how we think of source and how we usually think of source as external. It's interesting that Bodhidharma chooses metaphors that are about internality. Does that make sense? Skin going further in, flesh going further in, bones going further in, marrow. There's an interiority there. For those of you who are in my ritual and liturgy class, we have a ritual and liturgy class going on right now, and we're talking about liturgical expression, ritual, activity. And it's interesting that as Bodhidharma students are coming forward expressing their understanding, the first three use words, and the final one uses a gesture, just a bow, and no words. That student offers a ritual action. So if I were to argue that ritual action was closer to the source than words, wouldn't I be falling for some kind of trap? I mean, I kind of want to say that. I kind of want to. Like, oh, there's no words. But I don't know. If I were to say further from, now we have distance. Oh, now we have ranking again. Oh, now we have evaluation. Oh, yeah. No sources, right? It's an idea, now it's far from me. How close are we to ourselves, right? Zazen, the tradition in this thing we call Soto Zen, is a practice of turning the light inward, returning to the interior over and over and over and over. And although we leave our eyes half open traditionally, and we're paying attention to body and breath, and we're aware of sounds and sights and sensations, and the teaching is that awareness does not discriminate between exterior and interior, we also understand that although that is true, our experience on the cushion, our experience on the Zafu, is more one of what we would normally regard as interiority than it is exterior. I'm paying less attention to the shapes and colors in the room. I'm paying less attention to the breathing of the person next to me during Zazen. I'm paying more attention to the movements of my consciousness, right? To the play of sound in me, the play of sensation and emotion, thoughts, reactivity inside me, right? I'm calling it breath instead of air. I'm calling it personal and calling it me instead of not me. An interior process. Source, I don't know. I don't know. There's a saying in the Xin Xin Ming, the Faith, Heart, Mind inscription, or the Trust in Mind poem. That title is translated a number of different ways. There's a line in that famous, it's actually pre-Zen, but we call it Zen. We claim it as our own. There's a line that says, "Seek and you are far away." To seek, by definition, is already to be far away, to already have missed the mark. I don't know. Does that mean to seek exterior means already to miss the thing you need to investigate, the interior? Does that mean if you're the river and you're seeking for your source, to find it in the clouds is to only go halfway, because the clouds look for their source and they find it in you, because you are the river? You see how this kind of questioning throws us back upon ourselves. It throws us back around our original mind. Our original mind, which includes all of our ideas and our concepts, our cultural conditioning, causes and conditions, karma, our blind spots, our unconsciousness, our misunderstandings, our delusion. How close are you to source? It isn't even really the right question. Because close implies space, and source knows nothing of space. And yet our limitlessness and source, and this thing that we call the absolute, shows itself to us, and we get to know it through all of its apparent limits, through all of its finite expressions, right? This is the play of the absolute and the relative, the play of the infinite and the finite, the play of eternity and time, the play of emptiness and form that we talk so much about in our Zen tradition. Emptiness is form. Form is emptiness. The emptiness is form. The form is emptiness. The river is in the clouds, and the cloud is in the river. So our form, the fact we're born into form, the fact we have bodies with hearing and smell and taste and touch, and when I clap my hands you can hear me. When you pick up something that's hot, you know it's hot. When it's chillier this morning than you expected by about 20 degrees, if you're me. How you know is through form, the sensations of the body. When we break them down, we talk about self as being skandhas. We explore these sensations. We ultimately find them empty, and yet we know them to be empty through the vehicle of form. How do I understand emptiness? Through form. That's how I understand it. Our form, right? Body, matter, is how we know consciousness. And of course, our consciousness is how we know form. When I look in the mirror and behold what I imagine to be myself, that's my consciousness seeing my form. Right? And yet it's through the form that I'm able to behold consciousness. So the building blocks, when we talk about these things as being finite, the building blocks of creation, this thing called hearing, seeing, touch, sound, sensation, there's an invitation in teachings especially in early Zen, to regard these as both infinite and finite, and from our normal way of thinking, our normal way of perception, we're urged to see the building blocks as something to look past, something to look through. I want to look so deeply into the form of this thing I call Busho that I see vast space, that I see emptiness, that I see source in this thing that I'm imagining is separate from source. Does that make sense? It reminds me of old-fashioned zoos where there are animals in cages. And we go to the zoo to look past the bars. We don't go to the zoo to see cages. We go to the zoo to see animals. We therefore have to, right, to look past the form to see that which is beyond it, to understand that this is an expression of the absolute. So I'm not distant from it, yet I'm always encouraged to see past. Don't be caught. And a good Zen teacher, if you are caught in emptiness or source, will encourage you to see past emptiness into form. Right? Hence all those crazy koans about the student who has emptiness sickness. They have emptiness sickness, and everything is one, and there is no nothing, and there is no me, and there is no you, and there's nothing, and it's all just this formless sort of mass. And the Zen teacher will tweak their nose and go, ouch! All right, where's your emptiness now? I just tweaked your nose, and it hurt, right? Can your practice get you back to form again? Don't get caught. We refer, my cage and animals metaphor around the zoo was taught to me in reference to scriptural inheritance in Zen. We have a scriptural inheritance, and it's beautiful, and we hold it with honor. And at the same time, we're always encouraged to remember, as Bodhidharma taught us, it's not the words. You use the words, those black marks on the page like bars. Please see past them. You need the cage. You need the words. But the encouragement is to see past them. Right? The Heart Sutra is a window through which we look. We don't look at the window, we look through it. Right? So, skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. I have mixed feelings about this koan. My understanding of it is incomplete at best. The answers of his students are reminiscent of different schools of meditation at that time and different understandings in that culture. So they're being ranked. I get that. It's a very human story. The standard understanding is that, of course, because the robe and the bowl, the symbols of transmission, the symbols of the truth, go to Dai Zhu Hui Ku, that he obviously won. He won by doing the bow and no words. You got it, you're deep. And the other of us, you beat us. Okay, good for you. On one level, sure. That's true. It's just a story. I have no idea. I get it on that level. It's fine. It's unsatisfying to me. If this is just a story of a competition and somebody winning, that doesn't strike me as a particularly useful Zen story. Skin, flesh, bones, and marrow is something we all have. Which of them is most you? Which of those things wins as being the most you? Right? That seems like a dumb question. They're all part of our experience of being alive in form. They're part of all of our experience of consciousness. Our skin isn't closer to us than our marrow. How could it be? That doesn't make sense. It's not a stepladder of intimacy. I've heard folks argue that the winner is the first one who said, it's skin. Skin. This is how I know everything. It's how I can touch you. It's how I can touch myself. It's my contact place with the world. I mean, don't we fundamentally, usually, think of me as the one who inhabits the skin and non-me as being everything on the outside? Sure, Zen would shoot that down and say, yeah, it's a partial understanding, but it's also pretty useful. It got me here today on my motorcycle, and it's allowing me to give you a Dharma talk. And it's allowing you to sit there and wonder what I'm talking about. Pretty useful, right? The impossible intersection between the finite and the infinite? The place where air becomes breath? That meeting point? I can't argue against that. I can't say my marrow is more Busho than my skin. It seems like a silly question. So when we sit zazen, we sit with our skin, we sit with our flesh, we sit with our bones, we sit with our marrow. It's all of it. We sit with our form, we sit with our emptiness. Are we aware of it or not is another question. But either way, it's a complete expression, and we understand that that's true. We also understand, when I see somebody sitting meditation, if it's for the very first time they've ever sat for that twitchy, uncertain 5 minutes, or this is somebody who's been doing this practice for 60 years, that when they are sitting, of course they're sitting with their skin, their flesh, their bones, and their marrow. They're sitting with their past, they're sitting with their future. They're sitting with all of their hopes, all of their dreams, all their heartbreak, all their grief. They're sitting with all their delusion. They're sitting with all of their moments of awakening and clarity. They're sitting with all of their attachments. They're sitting with all of their freedom. They're sitting with every single person that they love and hold dear. They're sitting with every single person that they mistakenly assume is an enemy. They sit with everything. They can't not. They can't not be a complete package. Whether they've been doing this practice forever or whether they've never done it before. That's the truth of how this is. Right? I can't say that that first 5 minutes of sitting is further from the source than somebody who has Kensho after Kensho after Kensho after Kensho. I can't. So what's the good news? The good news here, and to be very practical, we like to do that. I like to do that. Zen teaching stories and teachings around form and emptiness and the nature of consciousness and all that kind of stuff are wonderful. I think there's a place for that. In fact, I think there's a crucial place for that. But I've always been taught that where the rubber meets the road is right here, right now, this breath, your suffering, your experience, where is your awareness? That's where this teaching is alive now. Where is your awareness? What do you notice? What do you see? Can you meet it with kindness? That's the only litmus there is. So, on a very practical level, when we are sitting down in zazen, we align, we make choices. We make intentional choices about where our body is going to be. We're sitting in a chair. We're sitting cross-legged on a cushion. We make a choice. We sit with intention. I make a choice about what part of me is in contact with that chair or that zafu. And I make a choice about how I want to balance my vertebra. I'm not sitting by accident. I'm making a choice. I make a choice about how I want to balance my shoulders over my hips. I want to notice if my hips are far enough above my knees that I can get an arc in my back so that my sitting can be upright without hurting me. I'm meeting my experience with investigation and kindness. I'm choosing with my skin, flesh, bones, and marrow an expression, a ritual posture, a ritual enactment of the original enlightenment. This is sometimes described in the Zen tradition as, Zazen is sometimes described in the Zen tradition as ritual enactment of the Buddha's enlightenment. It's not meditation practice. Forget that. Oh, that means I'm trying to get something and I'm going to get this thing. No. It's ritual enactment. It's a one asana yoga sequence. Just make your body make that shape. That's all you're doing. Isn't it interesting to talk about it that way? I don't think that's always skillful. I just think it's interesting as a counterpoint to our usual, oh, there's this thing, I gotta set my timer, and da-da-da-da, and I'll do my meditation, and here's my technique, and it's gonna be really, really good, and at the end of the thing, then I'll get this thing, and if I do it every day for a month, then I'll get this other thing, and if I do it every month for 5 years, or 10 years, or 20 years, then I'll, right? That's fine too, that's all true. That's all true. That's relative, right? Relative truth isn't less true than absolute truth. And at the same time, skin, flesh, bones, and marrow just lined up in the posture of enlightenment. That's not to say that standing or lying down or walking are less enlightened. But it is what it is talking about is the intentional choice that we make. Where is your body now? Where is your breath now? What are you feeling? Can you even answer that question? What do you feel right now? How do you feel? Name me an emotion. What were you thinking about 5 minutes ago? What is your reactivity to that? What's being triggered in you? From your conditioned consciousness, from your karma. What does that bring up? What is that related to? What is it connected to, right? The immediacy of practice is right here. This emotion, these thoughts, body, breath, mind, bones, emotion, here it is, right here, right here. Here's our contact. And then, when we're dialed into that, these questions about source sort of get vague and gauzy, and they start sliding through our fingers. Why would I imagine that source is something different than everything I'm experiencing right now? Is there a now apart from this moment? Is there a moment that I can invent and touch as well as this one? No? Wow, I just have this. I only have this little bit of air turning into what I call breath. And now I'm relinquishing this thing that I call breath and letting it go back to air again. This little bit of river returns to the clouds, and the clouds come in and they show up as the river. And my skin, my flesh, my bones, and my marrow, one activity. One activity. Just awareness of what I'm aware of right here, right now. Meeting it with kindness, meeting with a yes. Meeting all of it with a yes. I see you, I will include you. I see you, I will include you. You are not separate. Anger, you are not separate. Sound of breathing, you are not separate. Memory of past, you are not separate. Anxiety about future, not separate. Not separate. Not separate. Not separate. It's a brave stance. It's a brave stance to take. If you follow yourself all the way back to source, you find everything. If you find everything, you follow it all the way back to its source, you find you. Only you know it. If you follow yourself all the way back, you find everything. If you follow everything all the way back, you find you. Creation was not incomplete before you were born. Creation will not be less complete after you die. Birth doesn't add. Right? Death doesn't subtract. But the way we know those things, through our limited understanding, through our limited consciousness, through our eyes, our ears, our nose, through our senses, through our memories, we sure experience birth as an addition, don't we? Even if we get all zenny and abstract and go, it's just made up of molecules that went through a sun like all molecules went through a sun, it's just a reassembly of things. Yeah, that's true. That's the absolute perspective again. Good. That's a nice balance. It kind of ventilates our attachment. But boy, when you're holding a newborn, it sure feels like there's something new here before that was never here before. Ever, ever, ever. And there's an infinity in its eyes. Limitless hope, limitless possibility. Is that not true? I would never want to argue with that. With that expression of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, would I want to argue with my experience? No. No, this is something new. That's true, it is. And when someone dies, yes, the teaching of emptiness helps me. I know life isn't killed. I know that. That's the Zen party line. Life is not killed. That's true. I know that that's true. I also understand that that expression of that person in my limited understanding as a half-deluded person at best, on a good day I'm only half-deluded, my experience is still one of something disappearing. It's still of something happening I do not understand, that I only experience as loss. And then what arises for me to take the place of that person is pain, grief, loss. Is that not real? Can I meet that with kindness? Say, yes, you too, come in. You're the air I'm now going to take into me and call it breath. Hi, grief. Yeah. High hope, high confusion. So our real experience is of the limited, and our real experience is of the unlimited all the time. All the time. Zen goes out of its way to mix these things up as often as possible and to switch them on us as often as possible so we don't get caught. And of course we still get caught. And if I have a big Kensho experience and I've got a great afternoon of non-dual awareness, I so want that back again. And I so want to think that's the real thing. And the part of me that's cranky about my taxes is the deluded part. That's the bad part. I hate that guy. I want the other. Wow, do you see what I'm doing now? How I've split creation asunder. The difficulty with teachings like this is that we know them in our heads, we have ideas about them in our heads before we know them in our skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. To make that less abstract, how many people do you know who are forever striving to hear in some way that they are good? They're successful, or they're thin, or they're pretty, or they're tall, or they're strong, or they're whatever that looks like. They're forever wanting the thing to say you're good, right? And you took Psych 101 when you were a junior in high school, and Psych 101 taught you they want that because what they actually believe is the opposite. And you went, yeah, that makes sense. I get it. Right? I seek food when I'm hungry. When I'm too hot, I seek what is cold. If I don't feel I'm good enough, I will seek for somebody to tell me that I am. Duh. I get it. Right? So we all understand that. And we all also understand, no matter how many awards, degrees, accolades, movie deals, whatever that looks like, come in from the outside, it will not change. It will not change the fundamental programming inside that person's heart that says you are not good enough. And until they understand that, they will forever seek from the outside. In other words, the flower is made up of the whole universe. Come on, Zen student, this is super trippy. Every single thing that's ever existed is contained within that flower. Yes, that's true. This isn't a teacher lying to you. But this is just an abstract idea. Until you understand that with your skin, flesh, bones, marrow, until you see that, it's just an idea. You're still good enough. You're good enough. You're good enough. You're good enough. You're good enough. Does it matter? Is it even getting in? No, of course it's not getting in. It's pinging, 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 pinging. Right? It's part of why we do this practice so much, so we become more permeable. The space between breath and air, between river and clouds, between skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, all those distances start to get a little more gauzy, a little more permeable. We become a little more vulnerable to what is underneath. What is underneath my seeking? Seeking, you're far away. You kind of want to say that to that friend, right? Like, sweetie, no matter how many times you hear it, do you get it? Like, every single time you hear it, you're actually further away because you keep looking out, out, out. You will not find it there. You can't find it there. I'm sorry. Sit down, be present to the arising of that. Do you feel the source of that inadequacy? Can you befriend that? Do you understand where that came from? There's where your investigation is. That part of you that's still wailing. Why aren't you holding it? Why aren't you holding it? How come you keep looking for somebody else to hold it? It'll never happen. Even the friendliest, most lovely person in the world, poof, is going to be gone someday. You have to do this. It's inside. It's inside. It's inside. Come on. Come on. You can do it. Go in. Go in. The invitation of Zazen. Then the knowing happens. When the knowing happens, we have freedom. We have freedom. I've seen past the bars. I see. I see past the words. I see. I recognize what's actually in this little pool is the moon. I've seen it now. So why is your understanding, why is your knowing as a Zen student so important? Whether you've been doing this practice for 50 years or whether you've never come to Zen Center before, you walked in the store 25 minutes ago and are right now wondering, what did I get myself into? Welcome, I'm glad you're here. We don't know anything more than you do. Why is your knowing so important? Your knowing so important because your participation in the Buddha way, what we call the Zen path, which is just the Awakening Project. Let's call it that. Your participation is itself the vital functioning of that thing. Your participation in the Buddha Way is the Buddha Way. It is the absolute lifeblood. It is the literal functioning. These stories about Bodhidharma, poof, it's your doing it right now in this moment. Where is my pain? How do I say yes to it? How do I transform it with the light of compassion and wisdom? That is living. That is alive. It's the only thing any of us can touch, right? There is where I find the moon, in this little tiny pool I call me. That moment when you lean toward it and go, what is this? What is this? I'm saying yes to you. I am willing to be in relationship with you. I'm willing to include air into me and call it breath. I will take you in and say yes to you. Pain, suffering, misunderstanding, memories, hopes, future, air, sounds. Yes, I will investigate. I will turn the light of my awareness on this. There it is, the vital functioning, alive, not depleted, luminous, complete. That is Buddhism. That is the entirety of the Awakening Project right there. So this view we have from the cushion, this view we have out through these eyes that we imagine are ours, and they're also not ours. It's not yours. That awareness belongs to all of us. That moon belongs to all of us. Yes, it's reflected in your practice right now. It's what we call your awareness. It's also not. It's also not. All the rivers have their sources in the clouds. All the different clouds have their sources in the river. So the way I think of it is, my favorite metaphor, I like metaphors. I don't understand this stuff otherwise, is like a little toilet paper tube. You know how when the toilet paper's gone, you have a little toilet paper tube? Well, yeah, you do. Everybody knows that. And so, you know when you hold it up to your eye and you pretend it's a periscope like you're a pirate? You guys do this, right? Of course you do. Thank you for those of you who are nodding. Come on. We're all going to die. Let's pretend we're pirates, right? Before that happens. So you hold it up, you know, and of course you can only see this little tiny, right? And we would argue that's a limited view. That's a limited view of the universe. I'm only seeing this little tiny tunnel, right? And then when I put the toilet paper tube back down again, now I can, right? I don't want the toilet paper tube. I want the big view. I don't want the little self view. I want the non-self, big, non-dual, enlightened view. I want the source, right? This little thing that I have is not enough. It's not enough. It's not enough. I don't want the skin. I want the marrow. Does that feel familiar to you guys? That kind of wanting, the wanting, the wanting, that just eternal hunger, that kind of never enough programming written into us. Dukkha. We call it dukkha. That sense that one of the wheels on your cart is just a little off. The cart still goes, but something's not right. It's not right. It's never quite right. And sometimes it's gross and obvious, and sometimes it's very subtle in the background. But something's not right. I want to put that toilet paper dude down and see all of it. Good. Keep wanting that. That's fine. But it's still just view. It's view. We get so attached to what we don't experience. We get so attached to something we imagine is different than. And I'm here to remind you that your little toilet paper tube view is the view. It's the only view. You're looking just as much into the infinite as somebody with no toilet paper tube. Right? This metaphor's working for me, you guys. I don't know. I'm just telling you, it's working for me. Yes, the toilet paper tube works. Of course it works. Of course it works. We're right back to that same idea of, like, does a second grader understand less of the universe than a high schooler? Well, sure. I mean, yeah, I guess, by measurable, that's true. And that's a good distinction to make. And yet, is a second grader an incomplete human? Someday you'll be real, sweetie. Say that to the second grader in your life. Someday you'll be a real person, worth everything that a grown-up is worth. Can you imagine? It's like you wouldn't even think that, because it's so abhorrent. Of course it's abhorrent. So when I'm finding myself doing toilet paper view, that is what I do to myself, though. Bad, 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 bad. I'm going to throw that thing down because I've got to seek. I've got to seek. Where is the source right now? Where is the source? Here I am looking right at it. Have you noticed that when you look at the sky through a toilet paper tube, it's the same sky as when you throw the toilet paper tube back down again. It's the same sky. Why do I feel I'm closer to it when I, right? Oh, Zazen, can be both. It can be this little tiny laser beam view. It can also be very, very spacious. There are times for both. One pool, one moon, many pools, one moon. So, because your witnessing is the only witnessing, then the pain that you see, the pain that you feel is the only pain. The suffering that you experience is the suffering. Your awareness of it is the awareness. The kindness that you meet that suffering with is the kindness. That's all we can touch and know in this life, is what we can touch and know. That's all, right? So, when that suffering arises, the suffering, and you meet it with your awareness, the awareness, you get to make a choice. I don't see you. I don't feel you. I don't understand you. I will defend against you. I will distract myself from you. I will think about weird, trippy Zen stuff. I will have another glass of wine. All those have their moments. Those are what we call defenses. They are fine. And we have another invitation, and that is, perhaps this suffering is my suffering. There is only mine. There is only the. Perhaps this awareness is my awareness. There is only the. There is only mine. Perhaps this moment of practice is the only moment of practice. My practice, the practice. No difference. No source. No skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Just the choice to say yes. And to hold the moment and all of its contents with kindness, including those I do not see, including my unconsciousness itself, the way that I get it wrong, the way that I delude myself. Hold all of it. There we have the picture. And we have no sense in that moment of there being a picture. It is just practice. It is a ritual action. Everyday mind. Right? So your compassion, your witnessing is the only compassion, the only witnessing that there ever has been, is, or will be. Right? Your pain is the pain. The compassion is the compassion. Which means it's never anything other than the entirety of this thing we call Buddhism. The path of wisdom, the path of compassion. If it isn't happening in you right now, it's not happening in anywhere. It's not happening in anyone. There is no other moment. There is no other suffering. There is no other awareness. It's you, it's you, and it's you. So your compassion practice, your awareness practice is absolutely epic. And it's also no big deal because it's just your life. And those are not two things. Those are not two things. Everyday mind is Buddha. Everyday mind is Buddha, and every place the wind carries me is home. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up with two things. One is, most of us find if we're really simple about our lives, we are either comfortable or uncomfortable. I'm making a generalization about the human experience. I'm either A, comfortable for the most part, or B, uncomfortable for the most part. Does that sound plausible? It's just I'm either, I'm doing all right, or not so great. It's a spectrum, but I'm going to oversimplify. I'm either I'm doing all right, I'm comfy, or I'm not doing so great, I'm uncomfy. All right. When I'm comfy, mostly, I get to practice something called recognizing that that's true. Awareness of, Buddha would have said, mindfulness of contentment. When you are at ease, know that you are at ease. When your leg doesn't hurt, know that your leg doesn't hurt. Do you have a toothache? No. Know that. Know that. Just be aware. My marriage is going really, really well right now. My best friend and I just saw each other yesterday. We feel really close. I am aware of that happening, right? I am meeting my experience of contentment with appreciation and gratitude. I am aware of it, and I will cultivate the emotions of appreciation and gratitude. This softens my heart. It increases my connection. The practice of gratitude also increases my sense of humility. I didn't create those things. I'm part of them, but these things are happening. I am grateful. Do you see what that does? It softens us, right? Appreciation, gratitude. This is practicing no mind, we would call it. or big mind, we would call it, same thing. And when I'm doing zazen during times when there's just not a lot of suffering arising, I'm doing pretty well, I practice non-dual awareness, just that spacious shikan taza, reminding myself that there's no difference between air and breath. Spaciousness. Shikan taza. It's what Zen is famous for, right? That's when things are going pretty well. I'm about an 8 out of 10, right? So now when I'm about a 2 out of 10, I'm not doing great. I'm afflicted physically. I'm afflicted emotionally. I'm afflicted mentally, right? I have what we call suffering in a relatively gross sense. I practice accepting that that is true. I recognize that it's true, right? When your leg doesn't hurt, you recognize your leg doesn't hurt. When your leg does hurt, you're like, I'm aware this is happening. I see you, hurt leg. I see you, marriage that has suddenly become rocky and conflict-filled. I see you. Fear arising around da-da-da. I see you. I'm including you, right? I accept that that's happening. And now I have a person in the room who is suffering. I'm aware that there's a person in the room who is suffering. I'm aware that person is me. That's actually a big deal. A lot of us don't know that, but it's true. And everybody knows what Buddhism teaches us to do with suffering. What do you do with suffering? You meet it with compassion. Compassion. When things are going well, I appreciate it. I recognize it's happening. I've got gratitude for that happening. I remind myself I'm not separate from anything. Non-dual awareness. When things are going poorly, when I am suffering, when there is affliction that's big enough to be demanding my attention, I recognize there's pain here. Meet it with acceptance. I see that you are here. I love you anyway. I understand that you hurt. I will meet you with compassion. Acceptance, compassion. Appreciation and gratitude. Investigation, kindness, holding, gentleness, right? It's very, very, very simple. We have nothing to lose. We have absolutely nothing to lose from these practices. So we get to practice like our life depends on it. That's what we get to do. And we also have absolutely nothing to gain. Forget it. Don't worry about gaining anything. Don't seek. Don't be far away. Nothing to gain. So quit grasping so hard, right? Practice easier. Try easier. Don't try harder. Try easier. See what that does to you. There is nothing equal to wearing clothes and eating food. That's from the Zenrin Kushu. It's the anthology of Zen and the Rinzai tradition. There is nothing equal to wearing clothes and eating food. Outside this, there are no Buddhas and ancestors. Like, if you think it's better than this, it ain't. We get to wear clothes and eat food. Right? Do you experience that as freedom and contentment? Appreciation and gratitude. Non-dual awareness. If you experience that as suffering, if your experience of eating food and wearing clothes right now is suffering, meet it with compassion. Ta-da! It's that simple. So, I appreciate you're here. I appreciate that you've listened so carefully to some of this stuff today. And I appreciate that your life is already a complete offering. And I'm just grateful. I'm grateful to be here with you today. So, thank you. We have a few minutes left. Does anybody have any thoughts or comments or complaints or poetry or sock puppets? Please.
You used the word trippy a couple times, but more than that, just the thought that some of us could, going back to the scripture known as Dark Side of the Moon, from the authors known as Pink Floyd, on Breathe, there's the line, all you think and all you see is all your life will ever be. Mm. When I hear that again, I will realize Roger Waters was referring to Bouchot.
Yeah, I should really answer his emails, because I we have this whole thing. It's a long story. It is. That is true.
All you think and all you see is all your life will ever be.
Mm-hmm.
That ties in here.
It is. If you want to explore this further, if you've read Ben's book Yogacara Buddhism, that's I don't know if Roger was alluding to that, but the idea of mind only, all we know is what we have experienced. You therefore can't know anything that isn't mind. It isn't consciousness, the arising, and that's really all he's saying.
Well, that's true. I suffer from Sundoku, the term I learned in the library downstairs.
Mm.
I have lots of books everywhere that I'm trying to get to.
Cool.
That one's in the stack.
Good. Do lots of zazen.
Okay.
folks, what's alive today? Carrie.
So, you've been teaching for how many years?
I don't know.
A long time.
A while.
Right.
Not too long, actually. I'm pretty new.
When you see people suffering, right, and you see them doing the same thing, like, and you're talking about like that over and over and over, the seeking, right? You're seeking,
yeah.
And you say to yourself, just, you know, only just go within and be with that. How do you continue to show up for people?
Oh. Without getting caught by frustration, you mean? Or?
Yeah, because I think everyone has to do that within their relationships.
Yeah.
And you can see people just doing the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Over and over again. How do you not get stuck?
Yeah.
How do you continue to show up with compassion and not to get depleted?
Yeah. What a great question. Thank you, Carrie. Did that make sense to folks? Did you guys hear that back there? How to continue to meet when we're in relation with others and we see how they are caught in one of these cycles of continuing to seek outside, 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 and we know it's not working, we can see that it's not working, maybe even they know it's not working, and yet they're caught. This is close to my heart as an addict, and that's one of the expressions of this pattern, is there's this thing, there's this thing, there's this thing. So when it's me, when I am the one who is bearing witness, whether I'm that person's friend or spouse or spiritual director or priest or whatever that looks like, actually the practice is simple. I start by recognizing the pain. I mean, literally letting it in. I'm sitting here breathing with you. I see that you're in great pain. And what I start to notice, the very first thing I notice, is the part of me that doesn't want to feel that. The part of me that doesn't want to feel that. The part of me that doesn't want to feel that. And usually, 9 times out of 10, the desire for me to want to give them advice or fix them is actually about me. I don't want to feel this. And so if I can correct this in you, then I won't have to feel it anymore. Ah, isn't that lovely? Plus, then I'm right and you're wrong, which is sort of sweet. I got power. Right? You can see the ego hook in there. And the sad part, I mean, about that for me is that's actually about controlling you. To make me feel better. It's got nothing to do with you. It's not compassion. It's not acceptance. So my practice is notice it. Oh, I see that I'm doing that. This is really hard. This person's suffering is piercing me. This is really hard to stay present to. That's it. And then eventually, of course, as I'm encouraging myself to stay with my own resistance, I get a little softer. I get a little bigger. I can stay with a little bit more of it. I can stay with a little bit more of it. I can stay with a little bit more of it. My resistance starts to drop. My defenses start to drop. And if I'm undefended against their suffering, does that make sense? I don't have any more ego hooks around trying to frickin' get you to see this, right? Mm-hmm. Then I know that when I'm acting in relationship with them, I can be acting out of genuine connection, compassion, love, whatever we want to call that, that isn't bound by my own misunderstanding, my own, right? And so I actually, there are times when I have given and actually received the advice, stop doing that. It's hurting you. Stop it. And instead of going into my, you're my enemy, right? I should be defended against that, right? I've just been attacked. If that person isn't saying that from a place of ego constriction, if they're actually saying it out of love and they see it all the way through, they feel it in themselves all the way through. It's not about trying to control me. And they've given me that message from a place of just clarity. It goes right in. And I can receive it. I don't know if I'm going to do anything about that or not. I might not. But we've all probably had the experience of meeting with a teacher, therapist, relative, somebody who you knew they were right. They were, and not right, right. I'm doing air quotes for those of you at home. I mean right like they're telling you something that's about wanting to connect to you. They see you. They're not trying to control you. They're not trying to change you. They're not finding you unacceptable or broken. They're actually, all I see is you doing this horrible thing that's hurting. I see it hurting you. I feel it. It hurts me too. There's something so honest about that, that we can be pierced by it. So my job is get rid of those obstacles in me. Because I can't offer anybody help. I can't offer anybody advice. I can't give them some sort of fancy teaching from any place that's genuine or anything that's helpful if I'm in my own way. So 9 out of 10 times when I'm meeting with somebody who's in great suffering, I'm just checking out, what is this about in me? Where's the suffering in me getting in the way of me feeling their pain? Right? That's the only obstacle in this room, because it sure ain't them. There's just a suffering being there. If I can't touch them, if I can't be with them, that's about me. It's not about them. So how do I meet this fear with kindness? How do I meet this suffering with kindness in me? And then the barriers can go down, and then I can. Right? So almost always the work is just me going, oh yeah, I know that feeling. I'm scared too. Why can't I feel this all the way? Oh, I know why, because I'm scared that if I did that, they're not going to like me. And they'll anyway, you get it? Okay. What a great question. What a great question. Does that make sense to people? A little bit, kind of? Okay. I know we're out of time. I would love to explore that more, but I know we're out of time. So, Mary Beth, did your paw go up?
Yeah, I was just related to that. The concept of compassion fatigue just came up, and now that you say that, it's almost like it's not really compassion fatigue, it's almost like vulnerability. It's like intolerance. Like, I think my vulnerability.
That's it. That's actually it. And thank you for saying that, because compassion fatigue, I hear that all the time. I'm like, how is that possible? That's not a thing. We're describing something that's very real, but those are the wrong words, because compassion? Fatigue? That's impossible. Love fatigue? Like, I really love you a lot, but I'm tired for the day. What? Doesn't work. That's not love. What are you talking about? That doesn't actually fit. So I get why that word exists, and I understand in caregiving settings we experience, but that means that's about our own practice. Yeah. So thank you for saying that.